This is an ABC podcast.
Trust in the media isn't what it used to be.
Why the mainstream media isn't reporting this, I do not know, but this is huge.
Sometimes it feels like no one can even agree on what's true anymore.
I don't trust the general public's ability to identify fake news.
So when anything can be faked, how do you keep your bearings? I'm Matt Bevan, and on my show, if you're listening, we sift the fact from the fiction. New episodes on ABC Listen every Tuesday and Thursday.
More than 3 weeks after the initial strikes on Iran by Israel and the US started a war, world energy markets remain in turmoil. The Strait of Hormuz remains effectively closed. Oil prices have surged, with Australians paying more at the petrol pump. An ultimatum has been issued, and we may be on the edge of another dangerous escalation. How vulnerable is the Australian economy? And is there anything the government can do to protect the country? Welcome to ABC Business Daily. I'm Carrington Clark.
And I'm ABC Business Editor Michael Yander.
Michael, thank you so much for being the first guest on this brand new podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here, Carrington.
Well, let's see how the rest of the episode goes. But so far, it is a pleasurable experience. It's not such a pleasurable experience, though, is it, for those people invested in the Australian stock market today?
No, and we'll see how big the falls end up being. But at its worst in the morning, the market was down about 2%. That actually pushed it past 10% down from the start of this month, which is what analysts call a correction when you have a fall from peak to trough of more than 10%. So that's a big decline. You usually get maybe one of those every year or two. And with Donald Trump and his erratic policies, we've already had a couple over the past year.
And then I hinted at the ultimatum that as we record this podcast, we're kind of midway through Donald Trump's 48-hour deadline for Iran. Now, the Australian stock market has had this significant fall, but that's kind of in line with what we saw on Wall Street to end last week, so kind of before that ultimatum was issued. But it is hanging over markets today, isn't it? And this concern that Donald Trump is trying to bring this part of the war, at least to the end, to open up the Strait of Hormuz. It's a big ultimatum. It's actually a very clear timeline, and he's asking for something very specific. Is there any chance that he backs down effectively from this ultimatum?
Well, it'd be pretty embarrassing if he backs away now, having made the ultimatum. The Iranians so far look willing to call his bluff and say, well, look, if you do that and attack our energy electricity facilities, we're going to go even harder on the energy facilities in the Gulf. And that's already what's got markets really panicked. That attack on Ras Laffan in Qatar is the thing that has more than anything else spooked investors, because Qatar is like 20% of LNG supply globally coming out of those plants. And now 17% of that is going to be offline for between 3 and 5 years. So the whole plant's currently shut down during the war, which is a problem. But that's a temporary problem. But you've got a long-term problem where this energy infrastructure that can't just be turned back on or fixed overnight is now out of action for years. And that's going to bake in higher energy prices, not just this week at the pump, not just over the next few months, but potentially for the rest of this decade.
Yeah, and I think watching this now play out over the 3 weeks, there has been a noticeable shift, I think, in to try to gauge the fear of investors about how prolonged this conflict would be. But I felt like last week also felt like a significant escalation in that we saw this strike by Israel on the South Pass gas field, which is so essential to the Iranian economy and so essential to their own electricity network. And then we saw, as you say, that retaliatory attack, including going after Ras Laffan by the Iranians. And it seemed to show that they were willing to go tit for tat when it came to civilian infrastructure. And that changes the calculation.
And that is why we're seeing this sell-off at the end of last week in the US, and we're seeing another sell-off. And Japan was hit even harder in the morning when the Nikkei opened on Monday. And it's because people aren't sure where the two parties are willing to stop. The lines in the sand keep being broken. You know, when this conflict began, there were probably two hopes. The first was Israel and the US were going after the leadership. They got the supreme leader. They got a number of other key targets in the regime, and it might just all be done. That didn't happen. Then the other off-ramp that investors were hoping for is the TARCO trade. Trump always chickens out. Well, so far he hasn't, and he's threatening to double down. The Iranians have showed no signs at all of chickening out because they see this as existential.
Analysts at the moment are being asked to almost be geopolitical experts, but the reason why this is hitting the stock market, why this is hitting the global economies, is around how critical these energy supplies are for the rest of the world. And Australia is in this kind of odd situation. On one hand, we are a major exporter of energy, including liquefied natural gas, which actually means there are some winners on the Australian side. Those companies that are actually exporting our gas are getting much higher prices. But we are also heavily reliant on refined oil being imported from other countries. So this is playing out in different ways in the Australian economy. And obviously, people who go and fill up a tank of fuel bear that cost directly, but there are some winners from this war on the Australian side.
Well, the problem, Carrington, as many people, particularly on the crossbenchers and in the Greens, have pointed out, is the big winners from the rising energy prices in Australia are ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, Woodside Petroleum, Origin Energy, Santos. Some of those are Australian listed, but many of them are foreign, completely or mostly foreign-owned multinationals. The level of taxation on Australian gas exports is incredibly low, so the government's not getting massive tax increases from this rise in prices, and therefore doesn't have the budget room to, you know, pass relief on to domestic consumers and industries without potentially stoking even more inflation. And that's why those calls for a gas tax have become louder again in the past week. And we, of course, heard that the government has asked Treasury to model some options about taxing gas exports more, because that would help soften this domestic blow of huge increases in liquid fuel prices and possibly the flow-on impact to higher consumer prices because of rising transport costs, supply shortages, potentially even rising electricity prices again if gas prices domestically start going up.
Yeah, and heading into this budget season, there was speculation about where the government would go in terms of perhaps higher taxation, focus on the capital gains tax discount, whether or not that would be looked at. But it does seem to be one of these situations where a crisis has perhaps changed that narrative. And although the Labor government probably still has some scar tissue when it comes to its last attempt to tax the resources industry through a super profits tax, perhaps this time around, when people are feeling the acute pain of going and filling up at the petrol bowser, that actually they're more open to the idea, as you say, of taxing gas companies more so that the Australian public wins more. Now, we'll see how this plays out. We know that the resource industry knows how to fight a campaign, and this could get messy.
Yeah, but as the saying goes, never waste a good crisis. And perhaps Anthony Albanese and Jim Chalmers are seeing that opportunity to do something that they possibly wanted to do anyway.
And the messaging from the government has also been difficult, and there has been memories of COVID, haven't there? In back then, it was all about the toilet paper shortage and the government telling people you don't need to be panic buying. There's plenty of paper to go around. But obviously, one of the first instincts for people when they see concerns about something they think of as a necessity, and you can understand farmers or people in transport thinking of fuel as a major necessity for their livelihoods, they went and they tried to lock down their own supply. Now, the language has changed from the government, I think, over the last few weeks, and they have recognised that actually we are more vulnerable than perhaps even they realised at the beginning. And now the language is about, well, actually, if you can maybe lower your demand, if you don't need to necessarily work from the office, maybe that could be helpful for us overall.
Well, and the International Energy Agency's come out and said as much. They've got a 10-point plan that governments can implement, and some governments overseas already are. Things like increased work from home, potentially some degree of rationing if it gets worse. And it was interesting hearing Chris Bowen out over the weekend acknowledging that now some scheduled fuel shipments from those refineries in Asia that were supposed to come into Australia between mid-April and mid-May have been cancelled or deferred. So far, only 6 out of 81, but we're still quite a way off that period and it could get worse. Refiners and fuel distributors are finding alternative sources. We've just had the first shipment ordered from the US, I believe, in more than 2 years. So we're starting to get fuel. But that comes with increased cost because that's got to go from the Gulf of Mexico through the Panama Canal, across the whole Pacific Ocean to the fuel depots in Australia. So increased shipping cost, higher base prices for the crude oil. So it is going to feed through, even if we don't have actual shortages. If we avoid shortages, it may just be because Australians can afford to pay more than people in, say, South Asia, such as Bangladesh, where already things are being cut back and there is rationing going on, and other parts of South Asia where, you know, consumers just can't afford $3 plus per litre of fuel.
Yeah, Australia is a rich country by global standards, and that gives us the capacity, even if we have higher prices. But one of the things that is interesting about how this is playing out, we hear about the Prime Minister being on the phone to counterparts around the world to try to secure the supply of fuel. We heard at the start of this that when the war first kicked off that Australia had contracts in place. I remember them saying May. People are now talking about April potentially being a crunch time. These contracts are obviously important, but each of these countries have their own domestic concerns, which at a time of crisis become paramount.
And we've already seen a number of companies declare force majeure on this, which means they can break their existing contracts. And in many cases, it's to put through higher prices. In some cases, it's just because they can't deliver what was originally promised. Pretty much all major contracts have that clause. And this is definitely an event outside of their control. So they're triggering these clauses.
Exactly.
Prices will go up. They're already going up. My colleague Amelia Turzon from the business reporting team's just done a story today on building costs. And there's already fuel surcharges coming through in the construction sector. So we saw in COVID how building prices rose. We're already seeing it again. And we're only weeks into this energy crisis. And, you know, as we discussed earlier, it could go on months and the effects could last years if this energy infrastructure in the Middle East is seriously damaged.
One of the interesting things about those negotiations, because as you say, once if it's outside their control, a time of war, many of these contracts are able to be altered, is that Australia then needs to figure out, well, what leverage do we have? And one of the things that we do have as leverage, the card that we have to play, is that we are a major exporter of different types of energy. And so when you're negotiating with places like South Korea or Malaysia, and you can say, well, we need access to refined fuel, you need access to LNG, that becomes part of that negotiation process. And I think that's now happening quite aggressively behind the scenes, and that might secure the position. What is interesting, I think, as well, at the very start of this crisis, there was a lot of talk about Australia not meeting the International Energy Agency's standard of 90 days of fuel in reserve. Now, Australia has many different arguments about why we don't meet that, but one of them is that it comes at huge cost. The government was saying about $20 billion to actually get that much fuel in Australia ready to be deployed in times of crisis. But I think this has raised a question about whether or not that $20 billion is insurance worth paying for, isn't it? Because we're now seeing that those supply lines to Australia can be interrupted.
And this was one of the lessons from COVID, which we're still learning and now learning again, which is, you know, we'd focused on globalised supply chains just in time because it's the most efficient way to do things and that therefore generally the cheapest way to do things, which is great when everything's working just fine, when there's no geopolitical tensions, when there's no great power rivalry with one of your major export destinations and also one of the major manufacturing hub in the world in China. But when you've got the two superpowers, China and the US, arguing with each other, and this spills over into places like the Middle East, where there is some element of this China-US struggle feeding through into the US actions in Iran, Australia's just sitting on the sidelines. And as the Canadian PM said, you know, middle powers like us, we just, you know, unless we group together and do something about it, one of which would be supply chain security, we just end up being the collateral damage.
So trying to work through how this plays out. So we kind of talk about different rounds of impact. And obviously, again, that the way most Australians are experiencing the war in the Middle East most directly is when they go and fill up a tank of fuel. Then we're going to see second order impacts, aren't we, when we start to see grocery bills going up, as you say, fuel charges start being added on. We know that the for example, international airfares or airfares generally have already gone up because of these fuel costs. But the concern is for the central banks, isn't it, and for the government, that once that starts getting into a loop, into the more embedded into the economy, that people are just going to be paying more for everything.
Well, and then there's the third order effect, if you like, is because of those second order effects, we've already seen the Reserve Bank of Australia decide to raise interest rates this month, which they might not have done. They might have waited till May if this whole energy crisis hadn't happened. That then has impacts on the economy. Already on the weekend, auction clearance rates are the weakest they've been in many months since the low point in the market in mid-December, which is a, you know, dead time for real estate. We're in the middle of autumn selling season, which should be peak time, but people aren't out there buying. People are starting to get scared about selling because of the rising interest rates and the global uncertainty. So this event has ramifications all the way through the economy, through rising prices, through rising interest rates. And it's one of the reasons why share markets are selling off really hard, because the value of shares is priced against the return that you can get from parking your money in government bonds or in the bank in cash. And that return is going up because of the fears around inflation and rising interest rates. And that's why share prices are going down, because you need a higher return from those companies to justify paying the price to buy the shares.
One of those few sectors of the economy that might be seeing some positive movement or momentum is electric vehicles, where this does feels like one of those moments that changes the calculation, doesn't it, about whether or not people are willing to take the plunge and to change the way they get around. Do you think this will be the step change that the electric vehicle industry needed? Australia's been a bit of a laggard, hasn't it?
It depends how long it plays out. If you go back in history, the 1970s was the death knell for the big V8 in Australia, and in the US as well. Those huge, I mean, they've made a comeback in the US with, you know, and in Australia too, with the massive utes and SUVs and so on. But for a long time, that surge in oil prices in the 1970s saw the rise of the, you know, 2-litre engine or even smaller, the small hatchback out of Japan, really made the Japanese auto industry and crippled this. It was the beginning of the end for the Australian car industry and, you know, the decline of Detroit and the US car industry as well. So if this lasts years, yes, I think you could see this cementing EVs and overtaking internal combustion. And again, the winner geopolitically from that is China, because they make most of the EVs.
Yeah, well, one of the because Australia no longer has a domestic car industry, we've basically opened the floodgates to almost every vehicle imaginable from around the world, haven't we? And that has meant a huge number of very cheap to buy Chinese models here, actually much more available than they are, say, in the United States or in Europe, which are trying to protect their own domestic industry. And it does feel like this has changed for many people that calculation in their head. If they were concerned, as people call it, range anxiety, or that it'd be difficult for them to recharge when they're going on a long trip, I think now they're looking at what's happening with fuel prices and saying, well, yes, there might be some risk still with electric vehicles, but there's a lot of risk of me holding on to a petrol power.
Can I afford $150, $200 to fill my tank if I can get fuel at all?
You mentioned the Reserve Bank calculation with interest rates. We do have a pretty key piece of data coming out this week. It was the inflation data earlier this year that really changed the conversation, didn't it, about exactly how the Australian economy was performing. This data is so closely watched by them, but also by analysts. What do you predict is going to happen?
Yeah, well, I spoke to the RBA deputy governor in early January before that inflation data, and that interview was very quickly blown out of the water by subsequent events. So we're currently expecting that the Reuters poll of economists is expecting inflation to stay about where it was for January into February, which was 3.8% year on year for the headline number and 3.4% year on year for that the Reserve Bank's preferred trimmed mean. That's the one that excludes the most volatile price moves. Both of those are, of course, well above the 2 to 3% Reserve Bank target and likely to keep the pressure on the board And we know there's division on the board, but it will keep the pressure on if those come in at that level for another rate rise in May. So homeowners would be desperately hoping, if they've got a mortgage, that those inflation numbers surprise on the downside. But even if they do, these are February numbers. So basically before any of this in the Middle East happened, that started right at the end of February, none of the fuel price impact is captured. So as much as this data tells us, the Reserve Bank's going to be looking well into the future to decide what to do about interest rates.
And it is a difficult calculation. Now, you mentioned if this went on for years, people will be listening hoping there is no chance that this goes on for years or we don't see elevated prices for a sustained period. But the so-called off-ramp is very difficult to find, isn't it, at the moment with Donald Trump? And one of the things that is so hard about trying to work out how this might be wrapped up is that Donald Trump is almost constantly sending contradictory messages. And I remember last week one of the most obvious examples of this was that the headline that people took out of one of his, I believe it was when he was with the Japanese Prime Minister, was that I'm not going to send in troops. But then the quote actually continues, but I wouldn't tell you if I was going to anyway. And this is the problem. People want to want some sort of clarity about exactly where this war is heading, but there is no clarity to be found, is there?
And at the same time, he says we're not going to send in troops. There are thousands of Marines heading to the Middle East being pre-positioned there. So, and, you know, again, Donald Trump said in 1 hour on Truth Social that, you know, we're nearly done, to paraphrase a previous Republican president, mission accomplished or almost. And on the other hand, saying we won't back down and we're going to go harder on Iran if they go harder on us. So, you know, we're at the mercy of the whims of a very unpredictable United States president. And I think the only thing you can guarantee, Carrington, is that it's going to be extremely volatile. And between us talking and you listening, things will probably have changed yet again.
Well, we do, at least the next time this podcast is sent out, I believe we will have passed this particular ultimatum. So we'll see whether or not Donald Trump does go through with his threat and whether or not Iran responds. But Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure as always, Carrington.
That's it for today's episode of ABC Business Daily. We'll be back with another episode tomorrow. Make sure you're following us on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search and follow the ABC Business Daily feed. And we'd love to hear your questions. If there's business or economic news that has you stumped, just like our Politics Now friends Patricia Carvelis and Fran Kelly, we're also here to help unpack what you're hearing and reading. Just send in a question, preferably a voice note, to ABC Business Daily at abc.net.au. Michael, catch you later.
See you, Carrington.